Good morning. On today's programme, lessons to be learned from fixing the hole in the ozone layer and the female traditional singer making it big in a man's world in Cameroon. But first we go to Bosnia-Herzegovina, and last Monday marked 31 years since Bosnian Serbs declared independence, triggering a war in which 100,000 people were killed. In recent days, Bosnian Serb militia held a march in East Sarajevo to celebrate their autonomous republic statehood, despite legal complaints and objections from Muslim Bosnians. The marches recall what happened in Bosnia from 1992 to 1995 and the horrors that took place at the concentration camps of Tirnopole and Omarska, from where Frank Scholdeis sent this report.
For many Bosnians, last Monday's show of strength by Serb militia in East Sarajevo recalled the nightmare that began in 1992 and lasted 3.5 years. Back then, Serbs in Bosnia declared independence on January 9th, sparking a conflagration that claimed over 100,000 lives. It brought lasting notoriety to Srebrenica for mass killings, for the brutal sieges of Sarajevo, Garajda and Foča, even the wanton destruction of a treasured bridge in Mostar. But if the Bosnian War did have a human face, it is probably Fikret Alić, a Muslim man pictured behind barbed wire in the tiny village of Tirnopole. Lying in Serbian heartland close to the city of Prijedor, Tirnopole joined the catalogue of infamy as soon as its primary school was turned into a detainment camp. Up to 7,000 men and women were corralled here, mainly Bosniak Muslims, but also Bosnian Croats. 90 of them never made it out. Fikret Alić's bewildered expression was captured by a TV crew filming from the camp's perimeter. Under a mop of brown hair, his face looked hollowed out, his jeans held up by a tightly fastened belt. That image made the cover of Time magazine, under a rhetorical headline, "Must it go on?" Like those around him, he stood in the afternoon sun, shirtless, emaciated, ribs protruding like a set of coat hangers. When asked what conditions were like, the men were afraid to reply. In fact, 7 prisoners were executed afterwards for saying too much. I stood on the same spot last Monday. Around the time, armed militiamen were parading in East Sarajevo. Locals in Tirnopole do not welcome curious outsiders. Drivers revved their engines going past, scowling at me. Maybe some had supported the mass incarceration of non-Serbs. Maybe others were appalled but felt helpless to do anything about it. Whatever their perspective, the fact that it took place on their doorstep means it's a legacy they have to live with. Bosnian Serbs were not the only ones to mistreat captives. Some camps run by Bosniaks, others by Croats, were no better. And despite its readiness to kill prisoners, Tirnopole was not the worst. 15 kilometres away, in the bigger town of Omarska, a mining plant was converted for the same purpose. Bosnian Serbs dispute calling it a concentration camp, but if detainment means murder, torture, rape, starvation, dehydration and severe overcrowding, let's not fall out over semantics. Omarska held another 7,000 prisoners, 37 of whom were women. All were subjected to barbaric treatment. 2 interrogation centres, one dubbed the White House, the other the Red House, became chambers of horror. Every evening, female prisoners, routinely raped by their captors, were ordered to wipe blood off the walls at the White House. Anybody brought to the Red House for interrogation was never seen again. An estimated 700 Bosniaks were murdered in Omarska. It feels surreal to see the plant back up operating as a steel mine once more, business as usual, part of the ArcelorMittal company headquartered in Luxembourg. Strangely, all efforts to erect a memorial to victims at the site have been unsuccessful. Last Monday, the primary school at Tirnopole closed for the Serbian holiday, playground swings swaying in the breeze. When it reopens, the children filling its classrooms are too young for history lessons. Not for them the difference between a concentration camp and a detainment camp. When they get older, the distinction may count for nothing, not if they just remember it vaguely as the camp that was here. For World Report, this is Frank Scholdeis in Ternopolis, Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Next, a rare piece of good news. This week, the United Nations announced that the hole in the ozone layer was on track to repair itself by the middle of this century. The UN report credited collective action taken by the international community in a landmark agreement in 1987 to phase out the use of ozone-depleting chemicals. But this week's success also highlighted the failure of international leaders today to come to an agreement that would see similar action on climate change. Our global security reporter, Yvonne Murray, sent this report from New York.
Listeners of a certain age will no doubt remember the 1980s environmental campaigns alerting us to the damage we were inflicting on the ozone layer with our hairsprays, our deodorants, and even discarded refrigerators. These everyday products contained chemicals by the tongue-twisting name of chlorofluorocarbons. Scientists had recently discovered that these CFCs were burning a hole in the atmosphere's ozone, allowing the sun's ultraviolet radiation through, causing harm to humans and all living things. Environmentalists called it a crisis that needed immediate action. Scientists predicted skin cancer rates would skyrocket. Politicians agreed that the cost of doing nothing was far greater than the price of change. And as the 1980s came to a close, a landmark international agreement, the Montreal Protocol, was struck to phase out the use of CFCs in domestic and industrial products. It went on to become the first environmental deal in the history of the United Nations to reach universal ratification. But unfortunately for the planet, it was also the last. Campaigners today wonder why world leaders were able to come together 40 years ago to save the world from impending disaster and yet can't seem to act today to address global warming, despite increasingly desperate appeals. The United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, heads to Davos this week, where he will no doubt once again sound the alarm on what he's previously called the highway to climate hell. Humanity has a choice, he warned last year. Cooperate or perish. It's either a climate solidarity pact or a collective suicide pact, he said. So what is the difference between now and then? Certainly scepticism about the environmental impact of human behaviour was alive and well in the 1980s too. The chemical industry poured doubt on the CFC ozone connection. Popular figures like America's conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh took up the baton and ran with it, calling it a scam by dunderhead alarmists and prophets of doom. In the international community, American and Canadian scientists spearheaded the campaign that would eventually turn into the Montreal Agreement. But Europe and Japan, where most of the ozone-killing products were made, pushed back. Famously, representatives of the French aerosol industry lobbied against the proposed ban on CFCs, claiming that French women would never accept inferior hair products made with other chemicals. Some speculate that the Montreal Protocol succeeded because prominent world leaders at the time understood the science and personally grasped the need for urgent action. Margaret Thatcher, who was then the British Prime Minister, for example, had studied chemistry and lent her weight to the ozone-saving cause. Meanwhile, the occupant of the White House, President Ronald Reagan, had himself suffered from skin cancer and was therefore only too aware of the harmful effects of sun exposure. But insiders believe that the real change came when industry stakeholders themselves saw the writing on the wall, with public and governmental pressure rising. David Doniger, now a director at the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C., was one of the architects of the Montreal Protocol. In a conversation this week, he told me that in the 1970s and early 80s, the chemical industry acted just like much of the fossil fuel lobby of today, denying the science and attacking critics, he said. But then, by the mid-1980s, they changed their tune and went from being opponents of change to wanting to be at the forefront of new technologies. Doniger recalled one industry lobbyist telling him that they decided it was better to be at the table than on the menu. So what are the lessons from Montreal for today's world leaders? Well, here at the United Nations headquarters in New York, climate change is moving up the agenda. In 2021, Ireland was then on the Security Council and got together with Niger, one of the countries most adversely affected by rising temperatures, and tabled a Security Council resolution to acknowledge climate change as a threat to international peace and security. The resolution failed, vetoed by Russia and voted against by India. But diplomats from Ireland and Niger believe their efforts at least set the tone for future discussions. But as with the ozone layer debate, there's plenty of pushback. Here in the United States, for example, a trend has caught on among some drivers called rolling coal. That's where you modify a diesel engine so that it spews out thick black smoke every time you accelerate. You couldn't get a more visual rebuke to the climate change movement. Nevertheless, campaigners believe that the turning point has already come, and the fossil fuel industry is waking up to the energy transition that's already underway, much like the chemical companies of the 1980s. And the lessons from the Montreal Protocol? Well, one lesson is we know we can do it, David Doniger told me, because we did it before. For World Report, I'm Yvonne Murray in New York.
Finally, we go to Cameroon to hear about a woman making it big in a male-dominated profession. Asata Buda is thriving in griotism, an activity which involves praise singing with traditional instruments. It's normally a skill dominated by men, but Asata Buda has been honoured by the monarch of her town in northern Cameroon with a distinction only offered to a select few. From Marua in the far north of Cameroon, Dorcas Akupe reports.
Griots are musician entertainers, also known as praise singers. They are traditional artists who sing songs of praise, dance, and perform in cultural or communal ceremonies. These griots are an important part of the cultures in West and Central Africa and perform with instruments locally known as algaita, which is a kind of trumpet, and with drums known here as tam-tams. Usually, when well-known personalities come for a ceremony, griots will perform for them and the leaders will throw money at them or put cash in their hands or pockets. The griots are usually born into a family of those practicing the activity, but some people learn traditional praise singing after realizing they are passionate about it. While the griot job is mostly done by men in this part of the country, few women are daring to become griots and beginning to excel in the activity. One of them is Aissatou Buba, the lone female griot in Marua, capital of the Far North, which is Cameroon's northernmost region. Aissatou, who is in her mid-40s, has been in the profession for over 10 years now, and she recounts how she dabbled into griotism. She says she was invited to a wedding in a rural community, Gazawa, in the Far North. When she got there, she was thrilled to see a fellow female griot dancing charmingly and boldly for the guests, an act which Aissatou greatly admired. From there, she immediately knew she wanted to become a griot and perform just like the female dancer. That was how her journey started. She left home and went to neighboring Gidè in the north region and was there for 1 year, learning and practicing from older experienced singers. She took time to see and listen to them perform, then learned it herself, a training which Aissatou says was tedious but worth it. When she got back home, her father was furious and drove her out of his house. He asked her to leave, saying she should go back and continue dancing with a group of men. Determined, Aissatou Buba left home disappointed but resolute to continue with her job. That is how she began performing in local gatherings and weddings by dancing and got paid for her services. She makes about 30 to 50,000 CFA francs, which is about 50 to 80 euros for a one-day performance. She then moved from just dancing to praise singing. During peak periods like Ramadan, Buba says she makes about 300,000 CFA francs, which is equivalent to 500 euros when dancing. She recounts that one time her father became critically ill for a period of 9 months and she took him to various hospitals, spending the money she got from her praise singing job. At this point, her father recognized how important her job is. Each time Aissatou Buba performs, she thrills her audience. Her brilliant performances have not gone unnoticed, as the Lamido of Marua, who is a traditional ruler of the Far North chief town, honored her with the title Sakimata, which is in the widely spoken Fufudi language here and can be loosely translated as the traditional leader of women. Though still single, Saki Marta has constructed her home and now takes care of her family, thanks to the money gotten as a result of her Guyo job. When asked if she is well respected, she laughs and says, sometimes her male colleagues are disliked by certain people, so it can be even harder as a woman to gain respect. But Aisatu says she is determined to continue giving her best. Saki says she doesn't take her job lightly. After over a decade in the Guyo profession, she has become a trainer herself. She trains other younger women and men from neighboring communities who are aspiring to be Guyos. For World Report, I'm Dorcas Ekupe reporting from Mara.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. If you want to listen back to the program, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.